At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Stuff that changed the world.
The mobile phone, the internet changed the world.
Penicillin, I would have thought.
I would say sanitation.
It changes everything.
Simon Tierney joins us once again to talk about, I suppose it's a variety of car, is it?
Yes, it is.
The SUV. What's the difference between an SUV and
I know you said that with utter contempt.
What's that? But no, because I just think things like it's like a Jeep, but Jeep
is a brand.
Yeah, oh yes. But yeah. You know, but people would identify a particular sort of car as a Jeep, even if it was technically a Jeep or not.
Which is like, what kind of Hoover do you have?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it turned into an SUV to make it, I don't know, was a rebranding.
Total marketing exercise, because these cars were conceived as military vehicles, and it was only really in the 80s and 90s that they started to be called SUVs, sports utility vehicles, to make them seem kind of interesting to urbanites that this was some sort of sporty kind of very cool car that they could use at the weekends. But it's just remarkable, Sean, how popular they are now in Ireland. There was a 4% increase on sales last year. 5 of the top 10 best-selling cars in 2019 in this country were SUVs.
Wow.
You know, they just go from strength to strength. And one wonders why they're so popular. I remember, I think it was when I was in college in the early 2000s, I remember there was a lot of people talking about SUVs at that time because there was a sudden surge in their popularity, possibly fueled by the Celtic Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
People were taking out massive car loans, which they eventually regretted, no doubt, on these beasts. And they got the moniker of the D4 tractor. Is what they were called. Because it was like, why are these people driving around plush Dublin 4 neighbourhoods driving vehicles which are designed to be in the countryside or over rough terrain? So,
but they're not really, though,
but
are they?
But they're not.
You see.
Yeah. Unless you get a proper one like a Land Rover or an actual Jeep, which is 4x4, etc., etc. But even those companies are now making much more urban ones, which you'd probably struggle to get over a small grassy knoll. But so that's where it all started. But people seem to, they love the heightened vantage point. People see them as being quite sexy. People like that they feel more secure, perhaps because they have a better view of the road. There's a kind of an idea that they might have better winter road handling. Not sure if that's true. The other thing that Irish people really like about them is that they're very spacious. So they're good for if you have families and stuff like that. But then you could just get a space wagon or a people carrier, but they're not half as sexy.
But you're higher up, aren't you? You can look down on people, literally and metaphorically.
Yes, which is perfect for the D4 tractor. So where did it all start, Sean? It's an interesting one. It started with the United States government call on 130 American car manufacturers in 1940 for a military-style vehicle, which was going to be small, which could transport people, officers, some soldiers from place to place, but that it could go over rough terrain. So it had good suspension. It was very hardy. We're going to ship these out to Europe. It needed to be very, very durable. And a company which no longer exists, it ceased to exist, I think, in the 1960s, called Willys Overland. It was a big Ohio auto manufacturer. They responded to the call. They were one of very few people who did, actually. And it was fortunate that they did, because it turned out to be an enormous contract for them. They came up with this idea of a very sturdy vehicle, which they called a general purpose vehicle, or GP for short.
Mm.
And the American government, they ordered 700,000 of these vehicles for use in Europe, in continental Europe, and in the Pacific Theater and various places like that. Because it was called the GP, American soldiers, they started calling it for short, the JIP, or the Jeep.
Right.
That's how it got the name Jeep. And it was an enormously successful vehicle. That was 1940. Then, a number of years later, almost 25 years, 1964, after the war, I should say Ford played a massive role in this, because Willys Overland was a small company. Ford came on board with the Willys Overland kind of idea for this vehicle, and the might of their resources helped to make it a reality. But in 64, they adapted it for civilian use. And that is really the beginning of the SUV.
Right, okay. And so when they adapted it for civilian use, the people who bought it from that point on, I assume, weren't immediately suburban soccer moms.
No, indeed. These were farmers, forest workers, people like that. Like when the Land Rover launched in the late 1940s, the Land Rover was a specific response to an agricultural problem. It was a man by the name of Morris, Morris Wilkes, the chairperson of Rover, which was a very big car company at that time, still pretty significant. And he was a farmer in his spare time, and he wanted a vehicle that was able to run around his big farm in the south of England. And he had a surplus Jeep, actually, because there were all these American GI Jeeps in Europe after the war, 700,000 of them, and no one knew what to do with them.
Crikey.
So people were buying them up and using them for this kind of work. But no one could get spare parts for them because they weren't exporting spare parts. So Morris Wilkes decided, OK, well, that's fine. I really like this Jeep. I'm going to make my own. So he used the chassis of the Jeep that he had, but he built his own car around that chassis, which was a very kind of boxy vehicle, which was capable of rough road handling in on his farm. And he called it a Land Rover, because his company, of course, was Rover. And he launched that in 1948 at the Amsterdam Auto Show to incredibly positive reviews. And it was sold, again, to answer your question in a very long-winded way, at this time, it wasn't used by urbanites at all, or suburbanites. It was used by people who needed cars like this, people who, like farmers, people who worked in, you know, mountainous or forested regions, and also a lot of police forces took out contracts on them as well.
I suppose they didn't have to look pretty. They had to look kind of rough and functional.
No, they weren't. And that's a really good point, Sean. I tweeted some pictures earlier. These original machines, they were very bulky. They were ugly, very boxy. They had canvas roofs. You know, the first Land Rover was made out of aluminium and magnesium, the body at least. They were very, very powerful, big engines and a lot of horsepower. So they were to do a job, a very specific job.
So when did this crossover start? When they started trying to sell them to people outside of farmers and people in forestry and the like?
Yeah, so it's hard to pinpoint exactly, because it happened at different times in different parts of the world. I've tried to identify a kind of a big moment of when they became sexy for the general public. This is controversial, but I'm going to go with the Ford Cherokee. The Jeep Cherokee.
The Cherokee.
This was a 1984 vehicle. And it's an incredible car. I'm just looking at it here. It's a very, very big SUV. Today, it would be described as a 7-seater. Very American, very boxy. But it was really innovative in the sense that it had a unibody construction. At that time, it was normal for the chassis, for the body to be put on a frame platform. But this was all in one, made it very sturdy. it was incredibly popular. Over the 18 years that they manufactured this vehicle, it sold 3 million units around the world. One model of car. So, and the key thing, why I kind of consider this the birth of the modern SUV, is because it was advertised as a sports wagon. And I think that's really the beginning of this idea of marketing these types of cars as having some sort of sports function to them. Of, you know, they were often advertised with throwing the hiking boots and the camping gear in the back and throwing all the family into it and going off for an adventurous weekend, you know, this idea. And that's why we call them sports utility vehicles to this day, even though they're pretty much completely divorced from that now.
Yeah, it's funny though. I mean, even though the Cherokee launched when? Like
84.
84. You couldn't bring out a new anything now and call it after a Native American people.
No, isn't that unreal? Yeah.
Without any comment. Anyway, yes. Well, so right, the Cherokee kind of did it, and then this was then planted in the public mind about.
Yeah, so the Cherokee came out, and that it became very popular after that. There was the Ford brought out a number of vehicles in the early 90s, which were just huge. I have to mention, before we finish today, perhaps the most famous SUV in television history, Sean, has to be the White Bronco. And this is because 95 million people watched this being driven down Interstate 405 in Los Angeles in 1994, not by O.J. Simpson, but by his teammate, A.C. Collins. And O.J. was in the back and under a rug or something. And this, of course, was the famous car chase. And people, for some reason, called it the White Bronco chase. The White Bronco just became so associated with O.J. Simpson. And of course, it was so important during the ensuing court case. If anyone has watched the brilliant Netflix series, which documents the whole thing, the car chase is a particular highlight. But the man who owns it is a guy called Mike Gilbert, and he bought it off OJ during the trial because he didn't want it to get into the wrong hands and be used for distasteful purposes, to use his own words. And he kept it hidden for a long time. But in 2017, he obviously was looking for a bit of cash, and he decided to bring it on to Pawn Stars.
Now, that's very tasteful. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So he put a price tag of $1.25 million onto the White Bronco, and no one bought it.
No, really? You shock me. Did sales of Broncos go up at the time, though, of the chase?
They did. There was a bump in sales for the everyone wanted a slice of OJ.
Yeah. Fleeing the police? You could do worse than a Bronco. Simon, thanks a million for coming into us. Simon Tierney there. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk.